Augustine said was, don't try to understand so that you'll believe. Believe so that you'll understand. That has to be the key, because if we try to understand, in other words, use the limits of our logical mind to establish and prove, for example, the existence of God, and then God becomes what? The projection of all our favourite ideas, or power, or dollars, or whatever it might be. That can only lead to atheism and disgust, because anyone who's actually thinking will think, well, if that's what God's like, forget it. So understanding is a proud place to start, though it's terribly important to keep it. And you won't end up believing if you try to understand first and then believe, because you're forced by the logical mind to it. Augustine says, believe, meaning open yourself to the mystery, which is everywhere to be there, and you will grow in understanding. The actual belief, not filled with too much conceptual data, but the belief in the mystery, the belief in the presence, the belief in the sacred, the belief that actually I couldn't even exist now. The best argument, I think, is the contingency one, and it's a springboard to insight. I couldn't even exist now. I don't exist because of something in me that says exist. I wasn't, and I won't be, in the sense of... So I'm here, held in existence right now. Let's not go back, just right now. If I exist and I needn't exist, then I must exist because it's dependent on something other than me. Now, then you can go into the oxygen and love and environment, you can go into all that. But if everything that I depend on right now to exist is itself contingent, that is, exists but needn't exist, there must exist now a being who is and holds everything in existence. Brackets equals what we mean by God. And so God ends up with, the concept of God ends up with basic philosophical mysteries. But if you lock all that out of your life, all that exploration that takes you further and leads to understanding and understanding and understanding, but I'm not talking about religion, am I? I'm not talking about ideologies. I'm talking about an openness to the sacred and the mystery. And I think once you open yourself to it and keep open to it, it's my experience anyhow, that you learn so much, because it's obvious in a little child. It's obvious in these kids coming to communion on the weekend that there's something larger here than what's going on in the pews. There's some mystery of love present. And you see it heroically in some people's lives and the sick. And it's such a wonderful journey. Who wouldn't want to go on it? And you end up understanding more and more and more and more, and it's unending. And I think that's what it means to believe in God, is to open the windows, open the doors, dare the journey in the dark, and watch for the discoveries that come. And I'd much rather do that than say nothing exists that I can't understand and start from that position, and I think you'd end up there. You'd end up exactly where you are, without openness to the sacred or the mystery. Now, there's got to be a lot more to it than that, I know, but something like that is... And I think the worst thing we can do is fill the concept of God with too much content, because that will turn anyone thinking right off. Because when I look at our world, when I look at our world and hear God spoken of so much in so many places, and most of it is blooming awful, and I just hate it. So if I hadn't have had a chance somewhere along to be guided into something more beautiful and mysterious, I'd be an atheist. I think you all would be. Because the gods that people worship in our world are unintelligent, dreadful stuff, is not done in the name of God. We could do without it all, just about. And the only time you'll ever see it done is when you see really lovely, gentle people who believe in the mystery and live it in a beautiful way, and they attract you like anything. the rest doesn't. We really should discuss that together, but I better finish this psalm. Is that all? I'm sorry to have. But it's unsearchable, it's marvelous, and our ideas are very... Everything we say about God is metaphor. It's all images. It's all attempts to find the best words we can to face us to the mystery. They never contain it or define it. Verse 4. One generation shall laud your works to another, shall declare your mighty deeds. On the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works I will meditate. The might of your awesome deeds shall be proclaimed, and I will declare your greatness. They will celebrate the fame of your abundant goodness and will sing aloud of your justice. Yahweh is gracious, tenderly compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in kindness. Almost, well, picking up the classical text on God that's in the Bible in Exodus and all over the place, but particularly Exodus 34, when Yahweh passed in front of Moses, the authors of this text had given expression to their basic creed. It's the basic creed of Judaism. Yahweh, Yahweh, a God tenderly compassionate. So where you find tender compassion, you find Yahweh. A God who is gracious. Where you find graciousness, you find Yahweh. You don't find Yahweh with theologians or cardinals or popes or people who pronounce the truth, inverted commas, without love. That's nothing. That's... don't know what it is. It's power, it's a whole lot of things, but it ain't the revelation of God. So it gets back to the Beatitudes, doesn't it? And gets back to qualities of living. Slow, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness. Whenever you find anyone abounding in kindness, whether they are atheists or Carmelite nuns or whatever, whatever, you're finding God. And they're finding God. They mightn't put the word on it, but the reality is right there. And what we want is the reality, surely, not the words. Do our best with the words. Faithfulness. So they're all the qualities of Yahweh. So whenever we experience any of those, we experience the mystery. Or as the medieval hymn put it better, in the light of Jesus, Ubi caritas et amor, Deus ibi est. Where there is charity, which is love from God, and where there's love that comes out of the human heart in response to the divine gift, there you find God. Verse 9, Yahweh is good to all, and his compassion is over all that he has made. All your work shall give thanks to you, Yahweh. All your faithful shall bless you. Wisdom chapter 11 reads, you love all that exists. You detest none of the things you've made, for you would not have made anything if you hated it. So the faithful, in that verse 10, are the Hasidim again, those who welcome God's chesed and keep the covenant. And Origen, the first and greatest of the, or well, of the scripture scholars, you know, he was Alexandria, where there was a great library at that stage, on Origen, then he went to Caesarea on the coast of Palestine, that Caesarea, and he was a great scholar and wrote commentaries on a lot of the scriptures. He writes in commenting on this psalm, the Father, God of the universe, long-suffering, full of mercy and compassion, is it possible that he does not suffer in any way? Do you not know that when he undertook human affairs, he underwent human suffering? If people call on God, he is moved with compassion and shares their pain. He suffers greatly from love and enters into the experience of things which, because of the greatness of his nature, he cannot of himself experience. For our sake, he takes upon himself human suffering. Clearly, he's looking at Jesus, like it's a complex image he's got there, but the incarnation says something about the suffering of God. I think when people are suffering, it's much better than say, oh, it was God's will that you suffer. Surely it's much better to say that God is suffering with you. Verse 11. They will speak of the glory of your kingdom, and they will proclaim your power, and make known to all people your mighty deeds and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Your dominion endures throughout all generations. And here's the nun, the N, part of the alphabet, and it's only found in the Greek and therefore the Latin and therefore your Bibles. Yahweh is faithful in all his words and gracious in all his deeds. The dominion of God enduring forever. Here we've got in Psalm 102, my days are like an evening shadow. I wither away like grass. But you, Yahweh, are enthroned forever. Your name endures to all generations. Verse 14. Psalm 145. Yahweh upholds all who are falling, raises up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look to you. You give them their food in due season. You open your hand, satisfying the desire of every living thing. It was much easier for the psalmist to make those kind of statements in his world, where basically when people are living on subsistence living, starvation was not a massive issue in the ancient world, but it is today. So we're experiencing things that I don't know how you kind of pray these psalms, but when you're seeing millions of people dying of starvation, you also see millions of people willing to help and giving their lives to it. You see all that, but it's a harder world, isn't it, to believe in. It's not a simple world we're in. And that's why I think we have to stop thinking of God as controlling and intervening, and that kind of image of God simply doesn't work. That God would intervene and cause a miracle so that people in Rome would be satisfied that the founder of the Opus Dei, and I don't want to knock him particularly, is a saint, because someone has a miracle performed, and God doesn't intervene to stop people in Pakistan being brutalized by, well, if you can work that out, go for it, but I can't. It just doesn't work for me. And our church still looks for these little miracles instead of the big miracle, I think. And is very intellectually very unsatisfying, or maybe I'm just too proud of my own bloody thought patterns. That could be the problem. Mm-hmm. But I just think you've got to think as far as you can. You know, you've got to, well, tell me if I'm wrong, but I just think one must be open to the mystery, but you cannot stop thinking, and if thoughts come to conclusions, you've got to follow them. You can't. Faith never, ever opposes the intellect, never opposes science. So we've got to do all our science, all our psychology, all our archaeology. We've got to take every... So I thank God for science, because it gives us the ground to enable our leap into the mystery. And we have to keep correcting our leap into the mystery as we get the ground more secure. So science is it's an enormous gift. And we've got to follow it and go the tough yards and really get it clear and not muck around or dismiss it. But I don't want to do that while I ignore what you see in a little child's eye coming to First Communion. What kind of a life's that? You know, what you see so much beauty and longing, and don't you? Well, people love. I mean, everything we really, really appreciate in life can't be put under a microscope. So let's put everything under the microscope we can, but let's not put human beings under it, or God under it, the mystery under it. So you open your hand, satisfying the desire of every living thing is a beautiful statement. And I suppose ultimately we're talking about the resurrection, are we? I imagine, but short of that. Don't quite know what we're saying, except we all ought to be wanting to be part of the process. And we all ought to be raging against the systems that keep producing this kind of poverty and malnutrition and evil, really. And then we praise the rich nations for taking the debt away that they put there in the first place is a bit odd too. But we're, people are trying, I guess. But I don't know that any of us are trying enough. So here's another little psalm. Yahweh upholds the righteous. Our steps are made firm by Yahweh. When he delights in our way, though we stumble, we shall not fall, for Yahweh holds us by the hand. It's a nice image, isn't it? That's Psalm 37. And Psalm 104, these all look to you to give them their food in due season. Same text, really. When you give to them, they gather it up. And when you open your hand, they're filled with good things. Verse 17, Yahweh is just in all his ways and kind in all his doings. And verse 18, which is the Q, cough, I'm getting near the end of the alphabet. Yahweh is near to all who call on him, to all who call on him truthfully. And calling on Yahweh, calling on the mystery, acknowledging our limitations and opening ourselves to the mystery. It's Isaiah 55, seek Yahweh while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. That's what the gospel was about on Sunday, about the five wise virgins and the five that weren't, the bridesmaids. There's a time to go to the bridegroom's banquet and it won't be there forever. So we have to decide now to move. And if I don't decide now and put it off, I'll put it off tomorrow and I'll put it off the next day and I'll put it off the next day and then I'll be dying and it'll be too, you know what I mean? We've got to take the moment, carpe diem, is that it? Seize the moment, which is now, for the next step of love, and trim the lamps. So call on Yahweh while he is to be found. Don't put it off as though it's not important. Call on him while he's near. Psalm 22. This is the beautiful psalm someone referred to earlier, the Jesus from the cross, Joanna, you did. This is the one that begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it goes on to say in verses 9 to 11 very beautifully, it was you who took me from the womb. That's why Jesus on the cross wants to call out to his Father. You took me from the womb. You kept me safe on my mother's breasts. On you I was cast from my birth, the way a little baby was cast onto the knees of the dad, who then said, this is my child, and named the child. On you I was cast from my birth. Since my mother bore me, you've been my God. Well, don't be far from me. Trouble is near and there's no one to help. I need you now, says Jesus on the cross. And God was there with him, but God didn't intervene and take him off the cross. God held him through that dreadful mess. And yet we grew up, I grew up, didn't affect me very much, I don't want to say that, but I think we grew up with a theology that God organized the crucifixion. Oh, God, how appalling. I forgot to say it was Pilate and Herod and the high priest and the soldiers and the crowd and the Pharisees and whoever was there, they did it. We didn't do it either. But the people who were there, we're doing it now to other people probably, but he did it. So that's who organized the crucifixion. So what a dreadful image that was for us to be given. And some theologians thought it up. So they filled the concept of God with somebody who is offended by sin and so needs to be assuaged, sorted out from anger. So then he crucifies somebody who, by the way, is God. So that gets it equal. You following the logic? So we're all saved. God, blimey, Charlie. And people believed it, wrote books about it and handed it on. So what the hell am I saying now? That I believe and hand on to you and you're handing on to someone. You know, all our words are crumbling, so let's do our best, but let's be pretty humble about it. And if I'm not sounding humble, I hope I am, because, you know, I mean, don't let's be too sure we got it right, but let's call what's wrong, wrong. and then help work it out, and don't just repeat the stuff. So God is the one who holds Jesus there, as he will hold you and held the martyrs, and is looking after these people in Pakistan, and is inspiring doctors sans frontières, you know, to give their medical assistance to them, and helping people organise this massive world effort to get food and shelter to them. And you know, wherever you see love, you see God. But wherever you don't see love, you're seeing what you and I do when we're not at our best. Verse 19, Resh, the R. He fulfills the desire of all who fear him, all who are entering into the mystery and staying there and not letting it go and daring to believe with all the wonder of what's happening, though they can't prove it or lock it in. But they know that life makes no sense without it, and they know that with it you just keep understanding more and more and more. So the fruit, by their fruit you'll know, you keep growing. And the last verses of our psalm, Yahweh watches over all who love him, but all the wicked he will destroy. My mouth will utter the praise of Yahweh. All flesh will bless his holy name forever and ever. That's the end of the psalm, but I want to give you three little reflections, if you've got time for me to go through. One is a reflection by St. Augustine on this, what our psalm's been about, the all-comprehensiveness of the mystery of God's wonderful presence in our world. And so let's look at Augustine first. Augustine writes, look at the whole fabric of creation, all its intricate and ordered beauty, its harmony swelling to a crescendo from the simplest to the most intricate forms, only to descend again without interruption, splendid in its variation. All of creation praises the glory of God. Now Augustine can write that, and he doesn't know a thousandth of what you know and I know today, thanks to science, thanks to what we know about the cosmos and the cells in the human body. And you know, we've got so much, such a gift we've been given, the intricacies and forms of nature that Augustine couldn't have even dreamed of. So we've got many more reasons for believing in God than Augustine ever had. In what sense can we say that God is praised, he says? God is praised when we, contemplating creation and finding it beautiful, praise God. The perfection of the earth is like a voice that is mute. Let us fix our gaze upon it and see its beauty. Let us look at the life constantly bursting forth, the energy, the wonder of the seed that gives birth to something so much grander than itself. Let us see it, and in our contemplation, seek answers to our questions. Let us allow ourselves to be overwhelmed as we inquire. That's the fear of the Lord there. Let us discover the immense power of it all, its beauty, its energy. We'll come to realize that creation does not exist of itself. It points to its creator. What we have discovered in it witnesses to the one who gives it all it is, and we are carried on to praise the Creator. And so, as we contemplate the perfection of the world, its very beauty responds, I did not make myself. We could all say that. I didn't make myself. Think of the people who are most beautiful to you in your life. They didn't make themselves. They're held in existence by someone much more, infinitely beautiful. Let us observe the world. All its beauty surrounds us, and we are part of this creation. And what of the beauty of the angelic world, which also envelops us? And what of the reign of God's love? This we do not yet see in all its splendor, but we do know to believe in it, even though we see it. so imperfectly. Believe in it. Believing in it, we long for it. And this longing enables us to bear all things. It is the grandeur of a perfection which will certainly be revealed. Not yet seeing God, we are in love with God, that we may possess God when we see God's beauty. So that's Augustine. Here's a more modern piece, 100 years old, Thérèse of Lisieux. On the Feast of the Sacred Heart in 1895, she wrote a little poem to the Sacred Heart. But what she recalled, she had very few earthly experiences. She only died very young, a lot of half a life, not half, but from 15 to 24, I was getting close to it, was spent in a convent, in an enclosed convent. But once before she went to the convent, her father took her to Rome. And on the way they went and they saw the open sea there in France, you know, from Lisieux over here, or forgotten whether I think they went to the west of, whatever they did it. And so she saw the open sea one day and the sand, and only ever saw it once, but never lost the impression of it. And this is what she says here in this poem. One day, O my God, like Magdalene, I wanted so much to see and be close to you. My gaze searched the immense plain, seeking to find the Master and King. My eyes caught the clear ocean wave, the star, the flower, and the bird, and I cried, if I do not see God, O beautiful nature, you are for me only one vast tomb. That's extraordinary, I think. All the beauty she saw was empty if there wasn't the one who was revealed in it there that she longed for, beyond it and through it and in it and all of that. Without God, it would be just nothing. And finally, because I'm Irish, and because Joseph Mary Plunkett was murdered by the British at the Easter uprising in 1916, well, that's the way it was. But countries do this to each other all the blooming time. We want to have power over everybody. And he was executed there as a young man, but this is one of his poems that he wrote. I see, talk about Jesus, I see his blood upon the rose, and in the stars the glory of his eyes. His body gleams amid eternal snows. His tears fall from the skies. I see his face in every flower. The thunder and the singing of the birds are but his voice, and carven by his power, rocks are his written words. All pathways by his feet are worn. His strong heart stirs the ever-beating sea. His crown of thorns is twined with every thorn. His cross in every tree. Doesn't it also point out the stupidity of capital punishment? Of what, like, they killed him because he was in the Easter uprising. So what are you doing when you kill anybody? What are you doing when you take the vote away from prisoners? Aren't we intending to do that in our country? I think that's, what are you doing when you, people who are down for whatever reason, you push them down further? What do we think we're doing? What do they do to Joseph Mary Plunkett, who died, I don't know how old he was, 20-something? Of someone who can write like that, now they've got ideals, they may be misguided by your opinion or by others' opinions, but you don't take away their life. You don't stop that life for a political cause. You just can't. But we do. We're so bloody stupid. So our last psalm for this morning is Psalm 145. So before we look at this psalm, I want to spend quite a long time, really, 15 minutes maybe, preparing you for the key themes that are in the psalm. So the key theme is that of totality or comprehensiveness, all-inclusiveness. This is expressed by the acrostic form of the psalm, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, down to Z, with their letters, of course. In fact, the letter N, or Nun in Hebrew, is missing in the Hebrew, but it's supplied in the Greek Septuagint, so probably it's just fallen out by mistake at a later, and so in the Masoretic text, there's missing a verse. But the Greek Septuagint has it, so we presume that was the original. Totality is also clearly stated in the following verses, just to get the feel of them. Verse 1 to 2. I'll extol you, my God and King, and bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you. I'll praise your name forever and ever. Verse 13. Yahweh is faithful in all that he does. Gracious in all that he says, faithful and gracious in all that he does. All his words and all his deeds, all of them. Verse 21, my mouth will speak the praise of Yahweh, and all flesh, all creation, will bless his holy name forever and ever. So that picks up that feeling of comprehensiveness. Now, it's a psalm praising Yahweh as King. Here's some other. Verse 1, I will extol you, my King and my God. I will bless your name forever and ever. Verse 11, they shall speak of the glory of your kingdom come on earth as in heaven, the reign of God, and tell all your power to make known to all people your mighty deeds and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Your dominion endures throughout all generations. So that's a second theme that you'll hear coming through the psalm. A third, the reign of Yahweh is gracious. Hanan, grace. So constantly shown by the beautiful things that happen in providence. He cares for and saves especially the weak and the needy. A key theme throughout the Bible. Here's a couple of verses. Verse 14, Yahweh upholds all who are falling, raises up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look to you. You give them their food in due season. You open your hand, satisfying the desire of every living thing. Verse 19, Yahweh fulfills the desire of all who fear him. He also hears their cry and saves them. Yahweh watches over all who love him. Next weekend, for reasons that are obvious from the readings, I intend giving a homily on what fear of the Lord is. I hope it works all right. My homilies, I tend to want to teach as well, you know, to get information across. So they can be a bit heavy, I imagine, but that's what I want to try and communicate to the community. What fear, because it's not an easy concept at all. We've done it hundreds of times, so I won't do it here. But fearing God. And it varies over the centuries. It will depend on your image of God. So often in the Old Testament Bible, it really means being afraid of God, because God can punish you and God can, you know, so it involves that. But then the New Testament shifts that enormously. It says, no, don't be afraid of God. But the fear of the Lord is still a gift, the fear from the Lord, the fear that is the gift of Yahweh. Fear of what? Fear of my capacity to sin, you know, fear of being caught up in the trammels of the environment and losing my touch with life, fear of losing life really by just wasting it and all that. So there's a lot of fears, but then none of them have God as their object in the New Testament world, should never have, but the Old Testament texts sneak back in, and there are certain people who are so committed to the Old Testament texts that Jesus gets locked. We we fit Jesus into the Old Testament rather than see him as clarifying it and leaving aside what was unrevealed there. Instead of seeing him as the perfection of it, we lock him into the predecessors of it, and we lose the incarnation, we lose Christianity, and we get back into some dreadful business. Well, here we are. Various characteristics of Yahweh are praised in this psalm. Yahweh is great, Hebrew gadol, and powerful, gibor. Gibor is actually a warrior, a hero, a soldier who's really won the battle for us. That's a gibor. Well, God is gibor, and God is gadol, great and powerful. Read a couple of verses. Great is Yahweh, greatly to be praised. His greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise your works to another and shall declare your mighty deeds. On the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works I will meditate. The might of your awesome deeds shall be proclaimed, and I will declare your greatness. And verse 11, all creatures shall tell of your power to make known to all people your mighty deeds. Another characteristic of God that shows in this all-comprehensive psalm, which we haven't started yet, but preparing you for it, is the glory of God, the kavod of God. Kavod really means heavy, and therefore it was used of heavy things like gold, which was heavy, and heavy on the scales would weigh down, you know, so it became to mean important, significant, something like that, and so it ends up being glory. So on the glorious splendor of your majesty I will meditate. All creatures shall speak of the glory of your kingdom, to make known to all people the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Another characteristic of Yahweh is that Yahweh is good, Tov. All generations shall celebrate the fame of your abundant goodness. Verse 7, verse 9, Yahweh is good to all. And the further characteristic that it picks up is God is righteous. Yahweh is righteous or just. Tzaddik. All generations shall sing aloud of all your righteousness. Yahweh is just in all his ways. Obviously, when I get to the psalm, I'm not going to do much meditating. I'm just going to read it, but I'm just trying to get you prepared for the themes. Another aspect is God is gracious. Hanun, the adjective. Hanan. Constantly revealing God by gracious action. Verse 8, Yahweh is gracious. And here, verse 13, this is the verse that's not in the Hebrew text, but Yahweh is gracious in all his deeds. Another characteristic that will come out is the tender compassion. This is the word from the meaning womb, the rehem. So rahum, again the adjective, tenderly compassionate, like a mother is for the child in her womb. That's the image. Verse 8 and verse 9 both speak of that. Yahweh is tenderly compassionate. Compassion is over all that he has made. It's a very beautiful image. It's getting really to the heart of faith. Another one is Yahweh's love is long-suffering. And erek apayim, slow to anger is the way it's translated, and that's not a bad translation. It means, it's a bit more than that. It really means, there's two words for patient in the New Testament, in the Greek New Testament. One of them means bearing up under pressure, upomone. Menein means stay, remain. Remain, same word in English, menein. So that means staying under something and not ducking or getting away. It's a heavy burden laid on you, but you stay there for your sick child or for the work that you've got to do with all the pressure, etc. Or in the presbytery, even though it's getting too hard or whatever, you know. That's patience. But there's another word, makrothumia is the Greek, which means, makro means long. Thumia has got the idea of heat or energy or something. So makrothumia means not patient in the, you find it in the, love is patient, love is kind. But it isn't hupomone, it isn't love is something, I mean that's true that it does, and it says at the end, love bears all things, it says that. So yes, but this is the other sense of patient, meaning you continue doing what you do, you continue loving even though you're not getting much response. So it's the positive energy of love that keeps going, long-suffering. It takes a long time to stop loving. God never stops loving. So it's the, and we're asked to be like that too, to keep on being energetic in our loving, even though there's not much encouragement from anywhere. Well, there it is. I've said a lot. Sorry, I said too much there. But that's God's love is like that. And Yahweh's steadfast covenant, love or kindness, the chesed of God. It means all those things. Abounding in kindness, kind or chesed in everything he does. And a few more characteristics and then we can come to our psalm. The psalm will speak of Yahweh's faithfulness, emunah, faithful, full of faith. Yahweh is faithful in all his works. Yahweh is close, that's verse 13, that doesn't occur in the Hebrew, but it's there. Yahweh is close, karuv. Yahweh is near to all who call on him, to all who call on him in truth. He's near to us. And finally, the kodesh, holy, transcendent, beyond. Take your shoes off before you go into the mosque. The kodesh, the holy place. So let us go now and look at our psalm. In the brackets before the psalm, I've given you, and it's also written in the copy you've got there, the Hebrew alphabet. I don't have to go through it all with you, but that's the Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Daleth, etc., their alphabet, to show you that it's an acrostic psalm. And that really means it wants to be all-encompassing, A to Z. In fact, Aleph to Tau. T is the last letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So I won't refer to that again, I'll just read it. Verse 1. I will extol you, my King and my God, and bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you and praise your name forever and ever. Great is Yahweh, greatly to be praised. His greatness cannot be fathomed. These days there's a lot of talk about, you know, Darwinism. There's so much loose thinking in it all, it drives me balmy, but anyhow there is. And then there's this intelligent design, you hear that kind of argument, what are we to teach in schools? But the philosophy underlying both opinions is not deep enough. We lack philosophy, don't we? We do here anyhow. I think Germany and France are better, that's part of their secondary education, is a kind of philosophy they kind of learn. I think we've got to get back to that. What you do when you think, how to protect yourself against repeating stuff that doesn't add up, you know. So all that, the proofs for the existence of God are really worth exploring properly, philosophically, to see what sense we can make of it. And they are there to be discovered. But in a world where nothing seems to matter, or every opinion's as good as every other opinion, and nothing gets down to bedrock, nothing goes down till you get the bedrock. It's kind of built on sand. People aren't thinking clearly. So we end up with all these half debates going on. And you need an Aristotle to come in and just say, wait a minute, what do you mean when you say that? And kind of sort it through a bit. Yes.
It travels devil.
Yes, there's another example of over-faith. If you take a thing from the wrong place and put it wrongly and treat philosophy as though it's science, well, then people can dismiss it as science because it isn't science. And there's a terrible danger that in dismissing it as science, they'll just simply dismiss it. Then they're forced back to the only truths are those that you can prove with a pipette, the scientific truths. Whereas philosophy is always asking, what do you mean when you say this? What do the words mean? What's underneath this? What's going on? You know, it's trying to penetrate in to ask the fundamental questions about the meaning of life. And I think if the more you do that, the more the existence of God becomes totally obvious, as long as you don't fill the word God up with too much content. The mystery, the... Anyhow, I might go into it. That's not the right place to do it. But I think we should... we need to think clearly a bit better because there's not much around, I don't think. So, okay, back to this, sorry. Here's Isaiah chapter 40. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Yahweh is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He doesn't faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. Job, as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause. He does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. And Job again, he does great things beyond understanding and marvelous things without number.